On the other side of the debate, we've had the entertainment industry blaming the NRA and guns.
Can we not do a better job on controlling the weapons of violence that get to the wrong hands?
What both sides have failed to mention is how for years they've been mutually reinforcing parts of the same culture of violence and have profited handsomely from one another. And the reason this matters so much is that while we've been debating whether guns or movies and video games are more to blame for violence, we've missed what the culture teaches boys about what it means to be a man. We often talk about violence being a learned behavior, but it's more to the point to say that it's a taught behavior. And by shifting the focus from learned to taught, we shift the onus of responsibility onto those of us who are teaching our sons what it means to be a man. Since the 1970s, sociologists and other researchers have identified a consistent set of messages the culture sends boys about what it means to be a real man. William Pollack introduced the idea of a boy code, in which boys are taught from a very early age to act tough and not show their feelings. Michael Kimmel extended the reach of the boy code into late adolescence and young adulthood, where he describes a guy code in which young men police each other into conformity with dictates about manhood that come with an implicit and sometimes explicit warning. Don't slip up or you risk being unmasked and found out as someone who doesn't measure up. The result is that guys are put into a box that turns out to be the perfect breeding ground for violence. We can't show any emotion except anger. We can't think too much or seem too intellectual. We can't back down when someone disrespects us. We have to show we're tough enough to inflict physical pain and take it in turn. We're supposed to be sexually aggressive with women. Anything short of full-scale emotional shutdown becomes a source of humiliation and shame. And in response, young men learn to adopt what I call the tough guys, the front so many young men put up to shield their vulnerabilities and avoid being ridiculed. But it doesn't just come from their peer groups. It comes from fathers, coaches, and older male role models as well. Eastwood's character, like so many fathers, father figures, coaches, and other men in boys' lives, assumes the role of the director and proceeds to evaluate how well the young man performs his role. It doesn't matter how unnatural, complicated, or ridiculous the role is, boys are expected to learn their lines and master the tough guys, or else risk being shamed as less than a man. A pair of animated films show very clearly how this process is passed down intergenerationally.
Lenny, you see something, you kill it, you eat it, period. Thanks. That's what sharks do. That's a fine tradition. What's the matter with you?
Right here in front of me now, eat this.
In Shark Tale, the father shark makes it clear to his son, who is a vegetarian, that he has no choice but to conform to shark norms and become carnivorous and aggressive.
Frankie, I want you to take Lenny out, show him the ropes.
Oh, come on, Pop.
Son, you're gonna learn how to be a shark, whether you like it or not.
I'm gonna kill you, dragon.
Similarly, in How to Train Your Dragon, the son of a Viking leader runs into problems when he refuses to act violently. And the unwillingness of the boy to use violence causes a crisis in his relationship with his warrior father.
I don't want to fight dragons.
Come on, yes you do.
Who can't even comprehend that his son might not want to follow in his violent footsteps. Qualities like compassion, caring, empathy, intellectual curiosity, fear, vulnerability, even love. Basic human qualities that boys have inside them every bit as much as girls do. Get methodically driven out of them by a sexist culture that labels these things unmanly, feminine, womanly, and teaches boys to avoid them at all costs. And, most importantly, they're taught that real men turn to violence not as a last resort, but as the go-to method of resolving disputes. And also as the primary means of winning respect and establishing masculine credibility.
K-Rez Radio, the voice of the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation.
In the groundbreaking film Smoke Signals, one of the first features produced by Native Americans, there's a memorable scene where an older kid tries to teach a younger kid how to be a real-life Hollywood Indian. The scene is funny, but it also shows how the pressure to conform to ideals of violent masculinity cuts across racial, ethnic, and class lines. As the sociologist Richard Majors has pointed out, African-American and other men of color in urban areas often adopt a hyper-masculine, menacing persona he calls the cool pose to signal that they're still men, regardless of what else has been stripped from them. This is also true with Latino men,
checkmate, boo-boo,
who are disproportionately portrayed in Hollywood as gangbangers, Mexican drug lords, and thugs in the barrio, images that are crude stereotypes, but which nonetheless have become symbols of toughness to some poor and working-class Latinos whose manhood has been undermined by class exploitation and ethnic discrimination. And we see the same thing when it comes to Asian masculinity. In American popular culture, Asian men have long been emasculated, stereotyped as ineffectual, desexualized, and unmanly. since the early 1970s, running counter to this long line of neutered stereotypes is the highly stylized physicality and violence of the martial arts. But young Asian American men don't just have to look to Bruce Lee for cues. Increasingly, we've seen the phenomenon of Asian guys adopting the tough guy street styles of African American and Latino men to establish their masculine credentials. Middle-class white boys may not have a lot of experience with the kind of real-world inner-city conditions that gave rise to the cool pose, but the culture tells them if they take on this black, urban, hard guy pose, they'll somehow be more real, more of a man. What makes this even more interesting is that a lot of the very guys they see as models of authenticity are themselves projecting an image they picked up from the culture. As the writer Nathan McCall has said, he and some of his African-American male cohorts got some of their ideas of manhood from The Godfather and other gangster films that featured tough, ruthless, white Italian gangsters. And the same kind of thing about Scarface.
It's one of the hottest movies ever made.
This is the all-time greatest movie.
Never seen nothing like that.
I watched this movie 63 times.
So we have this interesting phenomenon where we have white middle-class males emulating poor urban black males who in turn are getting part of their idea about manhood from gangster films featuring white men who are playing Italian and Cuban-American gangsters.
Now are we made or are we made, man?
The paradox is that the test of being real somehow comes down to how well you live up to a made-up script. And it's a script that's only become increasingly violent over time. The American ideal of the real man owes a lot to the Hollywood Western and the ultimate icon of white American masculinity, John Wayne.
Young fella, if you're looking for trouble, I'll accommodate you.
While other men talked a lot, thought too much, equivocated, and showed emotion, John Wayne made the world bend to his will with just a stare, a few words, his fists, and his guns.
But I haven't lost my temper in 40 years. But Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed. And somebody ought to belt you in the mouth. But I won't.
And then there's Hollywood gangster films with cinematic tough guys like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart.
I'll move out of you, son. I'll fill your pants full of lead. Get over there.
Men hardened by the world who knew the power of a few clipped words and a few rounds of ammunition. And this equation between toughness, manhood, and violence has continued and in many ways intensified over time. There's no question that over the past few decades, there's been a ratcheting up of what it takes to be considered a real man. Our action heroes. In the 1950s, Superman was the equivalent of an ordinary guy running around in tights and a cape. And today, he's pumped up and ripped. Or Batman. The body of Adam West as Batman in the 1960s is a far cry from the far more imposing Dark Knight of the 21st century. Pro wrestlers' bodies in the 1960s were more flabby. In the 21st century, they're way more sculpted, pumped up, and ripped. And look at toy action figures. If you look at the Star Wars toy figurines that kids played with in the 1970s and contrast them with the Star Wars toy figurines that are being marketed to kids today, you see a dramatic shift. Well, the body of G.I. Joe. A study done in the late 1990s found that over the past 50 years, the size of G.I. Joe's biceps in real-life equivalents increased from 12.2 inches in 1964 to 15.2 inches in 1974 to 16.4 inches in 1994 and up to 26.8 inches by 1998. If you wanted a comparison to a real person, the biceps of someone like The Rock are reportedly only about 20 inches. We can see a similar pattern in the changing level of violence itself over time. We've gone from pistols in the 1940s to larger weaponry in the 1970s to the increasing militarization of these weapons in the 80s and 90s to the larger-than-life heavy metal killing machines we have today. We've seen video game violence go from the benign aggressions of Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and Asteroids to the unimaginable and hyper-realistic bloodbaths of today's games. We've gone from the comparatively orderly sport of boxing to today's number one fighting sport, the street fighting viciousness of mixed martial arts and cage fighting. Now, there's no doubt we're in the throes of some kind of a crisis in masculinity. But rather than questioning whether it's our inability to move beyond the straitjacket of traditional masculinity that might be the source of this crisis, across the cultural and political landscape, there's been a growing movement to reclaim and reassert traditional manhood.
We need to toughen up and stand up for ourselves and learn to be a lot tougher than yoga is going to teach us to do all by ourselves.
The basic idea is that men are in crisis because women have I've been waging a full-scale war on traditional manhood.
We've been so emasculated by a so-called women's movement at this point. Even our strongest men are acting girly.
The whole culture is being feminized, in my opinion.
There's a certain emasculation that's happening in our culture.
Part of the problem is we've sort of feminized schools.
I think she's right. It's 100%. We're wussifying America.
Is this the wussification of America?
Yes, this is one more step in the wussification of America.
Is this the latest in the wussification of America?
The result is a narrative that tells men that the best way to respond to change is not to adapt, but to reclaim traditional masculine control and dominance from the forces of feminization.
The founding fathers were men, not wussies. It's the wussification of America that's killing us.
And as it turns out, this is an old pattern in American history. Take the Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouting is one of the few institutions to balance the rather softening effect of our modern way of life.
About you, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Afghan debacle has dashed European hopes that the transition from Donald Trump to Joe Biden would restore order and meaning in relations. We now present you an article written by Daniel Williams, a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and Miami Herald, and a former researcher for Human Rights Watch. The piece is titled Broken U.S. Leadership, a Specter Haunting Europe. In the wake of the chaotic evacuation of Europeans and Afghans from Kabul airport, NATO allies worry about the reliability of the United States and the competence of President Joe Biden's government. Adding to widespread vexation is the feeling that Washington generally disdains Europe and undervalues the alliance. It marks a sharp reversal of European opinion since Joe Biden took office in January, having replaced the hostile European leaders expressed confidence that a steady and expert hand had returned to guide U.S. foreign policy. Adults were back in charge was a common refrain. But after Joe Biden's ill-planned exit from Afghanistan, criticism exploded across the European continent. Josep Borrell, the European Union's top diplomat, said, "It's a failure of the Western world, and it's a game-changer for international relations." He added, "The European Union must be able to intervene to protect our interests when the Americans don't want to be involved." Allies lost 1,145 soldiers over 20 years, while about 2,400 Americans died in Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of Afghans were killed, of course. The first line of criticism focused on Joe Biden's timetable for pulling out and security preparations for the evacuation of thousands of potential refugees. His withdrawal decision was made back in April, but the mass evacuation only began on 14th to 17th of August, days before the deadline he had firmly set for all U.S. occupation troops to exit Afghanistan. He also pulled out 2,500 U.S. troops before the exodus got underway, then had to send 5,000 back in to handle the crisis. All the while, Joe Biden expressed confidence that Afghanistan would not collapse to the Taliban anytime soon, but allies were baffled. In the British Parliament, the House of Commons, Theresa May, the former Prime Minister, expressed European frustration in sarcastic tones. "Did we just think we had to follow the United States and on a wing and a prayer it would be all right?" Joe Biden made tactical decisions without discussions with allies. To many, it suggested contempt for NATO counsel. It also forced them to hastily send their own forces into Kabul to arrange their own evacuations of diplomats and allied Afghans. Johann Wadepohl, a parliament leader in the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, CDU, remarked, "Nobody asked us whether it was a good idea to leave Afghanistan in such a quick way." Ireland's David O'Sullivan, a former European Union ambassador to the United States, said, "The immediate feeling around this whole situation is that perhaps there should have been more consultations and more joint planning." President Biden's unilateral decision-making highlighted Europe's debilitating reliance on the United States, not only for combat power, but for logistics. Once President Biden spoke, Europeans had no other choice but to scramble on American planes, not only to get some of their own 7,000 soldiers out, but also Afghan allies who had worked for them. The Carnegie Endowment for Peace, in a report on the situation, declared NATO has indisputable dependence on the United States. The Afghan finale renewed a long search for a compelling allied role following the collapse of the former Soviet Union. In the 1990s, American diplomats suggested that the future lay in NATO embarking on missions beyond European boundaries as a kind of global police force. The mantra was, out of area or out of business, in the words of late Richard Holbrooke, a top American diplomat at the time. The United Nations authorized NATO's first venture outside the alliance's bounds in 1994, when the global body asked it to bomb Serbian artillery and fighter planes. In 1999, NATO went to war with Serbia again, this time without United Nations authorization. in the name of a humanitarian intervention to supposedly inhibit ethnic cleansing of Muslims from Kosovo, NATO jets bombed Serbian forces inside the breakaway region and targeted Serbia itself, including its capital, Belgrade. The suspicious 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington provided NATO the occasion to go to war in Asia in defense of its chief member, the United States of America. At the war's beginning, Afghan forces, with the help of U.S. air power, overthrew Afghanistan's Taliban rulers. Later, American occupation forces claimed that they have chased al-Qaeda terrorists out of the country. NATO forces arrived on the scene more than a year later, both for combat and to take part in disjointed efforts to supposedly reconstruct Afghanistan and build its military and governing capabilities. That project, of course, came to a crashing end on 31st of August. For a future NATO role, one option is to revert to its original mission, to supposedly defend Europe from Russia. But even that mission raises issues of NATO's reach. The main action is not within NATO's borders, but on its doorstep in Ukraine. Is NATO, with the United States presumably in the lead, prepared to defend Ukraine from Russia's alleged military intervention? It hasn't so far. Would it reverse Moscow's 2014 annexation of Crimea and someday make Ukraine an alliance member? Neither of this seems on the horizon. Prospective hints may emerge when Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visits Joe Biden in Washington. He's concerned that Biden is bent on appeasing Russia, so to focus wholly on China. His evidence? Biden withdrew opposition to and sanctions on companies building the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline that runs under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany. Because the pipeline bypasses Ukraine, it robs Kiev of $1.2 billion in yearly transit fees and means Moscow can cut off supplies to Ukraine without upsetting Western Europe. Joe Biden once called the pipeline, the Nord Stream 2, a threat to European security, but once in office, backed off at Germany's insistence. Ukraine officials have ruefully noted Joe Biden's focus on corruption in Ukraine, which, though an important issue, strikes them as a way to divert attention from the military threat to the east. Further afield, Joe Biden wants NATO to buy into U.S. plans to confront China in East Asia and impede its naval expansion in nearby waters. It is not clear that NATO, either fully or in part, would follow Joe Biden on such a distant and potentially fraught venture. In June, France's President Emmanuel Macron argued against a NATO hard line on China. Macron reminded Biden that the group is an Atlantic, not Pacific, alliance. NATO may simply prefer to stick to its home continent of Europe. Some members complain NATO has been deficient in controlling Europe's southern Mediterranean frontier against uncontrolled migration. The Afghan withdrawal has further raised concerns about a new refugee flood into Europe. It's all feeding second thoughts about the alliance and U.S. leadership. Katharina Emschermann, a director of Berlin's Hartie School Postgraduate Center for International Security, said, "Part of the discord that we're seeing now is probably also rooted in the sense of unease about how things are going to go in the future, as well as uncertainty in Europe about the future course of American foreign policy. It is not clear yet if the uncertainty also results from the kind of U.S. policy lodestar that guided much American policy during the Cold War, that is, the need to contain the former Soviet Union. The post-Cold War expansion of U.S. global policy sometimes seems to value alliances and sometimes wants to go it alone. Its policy tools oscillate between promiscuous military interventions and under-resourced nation-building and diplomacy. Or perhaps the consternation reflects a hangover from the performance of America's last two presidents, the bombastic and unpredictable Donald J. Trump, followed by an unsteady Joseph Biden. In a time of bewilderment, a country that produces such leaders is not instilling confidence in Europe.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Algeria recently recalled its ambassador to Paris following insulting remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron that disparaged the history of Algeria and its state institutions. The Algerian president has responded to the outburst by Macron and demanded France's total respect for his country. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. This week's edition is focusing on the ongoing tension between France and Algeria, following insulting remarks by French president against the North African country. In the second segment of our program, we'll talk about how the United States Military Command for Africa is being used by Washington to loot the continent's natural resources in the name of fighting terrorism. Stay with us till the end of the show and send us your comments.
Algeria rejects interference by France. Tensions between France and Algeria have continued to rise following remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron on the North African country's colonial past. Macron reportedly argued that the official history of Algeria has been rewritten not based on truth, but based on hatred against France. He also went on to question if there was an Algerian nation before colonization.
Now, in an interview, the Algerian foreign minister responded to the insulting remarks by Macron.
What was said about Algeria, Algeria had the opportunity to respond to it. We reject any interference in our domestic affairs. We don't accept value judgments on the formation of the Algerian nation. Algerian nation is an old one, deeply rooted in history, a nation that has contributed significantly to the prosperity of the region, of the Mediterranean region, that has cooperated very, very efficiently and substantially with Europe, including France. Algeria has had diplomatic relations with France as well as with a number of other European nations. So we are at ease for what relates to history. Algeria is a nation like any other nations, and therefore we don't think that it should be subject to any question or any debate.
Well, for more on the France-Algeria tensions, we contacted Raouf Farah, an Algerian activist and commentator. He's also the coordinator of Youth Engage for Algeria and a member of the pro-democracy organization IPTICAR. Welcome to our program, sir.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Now, our first question, why is the French president adopting a confrontational policy towards Algeria at this juncture?
I think we should go beyond the contextual analysis and interpret Macron's saying as basically what most politicians in France think about the relationship between Algeria and France. And I think Macron's really underestimated the grievances that could create it in France, but also in Algeria, and this is probably one of the reasons why we are here today to discuss that.
Thanks for that, Mr. Farah.
According to some projections, the French president is now under threat from right-wing possible presidential candidate Eric Zemmour. Macron's re-election strategy appears to try to win far-right voters by making the elections not about poverty or economic crisis, but instead about glorifying French colonialism and presenting mostly North African Muslim migrants as the enemy. And all these are linked to a strategy of Islamophobia.
The Algerian foreign minister responds here to speculation that Macron's outbursts are related to the upcoming elections in France.
There are a lot of analysis. I'm not a journalist to enter into speculative area, but I read what you read, I read what you say as journalist, and I am very much interested in understanding all the situation, and I certainly believe that all of the factors that are being mentioned by the media have certainly their role in the situation and in the crisis which was created. I'm not in a position to assess which of the relevant principles have played a stronger role than the others, but one can intellectually consider that all of them can be relevant in the motivations, but it's not up to me to determine the motivations of a particular person.
Now, do you think there is a link between the insulting remarks by Macron against Algeria and next year's elections in France?
Yes, I think there is definitely a link. The organization of presidential elections in France always brings the question of the contentious relationship between Algeria and France. But I think it's not the only factor one should take when analyzing what Macron has said. I think Macron's decision is really, Macron's saying is really shows what many politicians in France think about the history of their country. It's in Northern Africa, and they see the adventure of colonialism as, to a certain extent, an enlightenment that brought, to a certain extent, again, civilization to the region.
In another move to protest the patronizing remarks by Macron, Algeria closed its airspace to French military planes. This will complicate military operations by France in the mineral-rich Sahel region where Paris claims is fighting terrorists. Contrary to these claims, it's believed that the French army is in the Sahel to protect the country's economic interests in a region rich in uranium, gold, oil, and other minerals.
Mr. Farah, what's your take on the reaction by Algeria, including closing its airspace for the French military following the remarks by Macron?
One should know that Algeria opened its airspace to the French mission, not Barkhane, but a mission called Serval, which is the ancestor of the Barkhane operation. And since then, the Bouteflika regime from 2013 until his end in 2019 didn't really put an end to that. So I think the Algerian regime took advantage of this very tenuous situation between the two countries to take a step back on what was at that time a controversial decision. And I think after Macron saying it's pretty much normal to see that the Algerian ambassador is called back in his country.
Now, Turkey's foreign minister Mevlut Cavusoglu has slammed what he termed as Macron's extremely wrong and populist comments on Turkey and Algeria about colonialism. Now, Macron negatively mentioned Turkey in his anti-Algeria remarks. Is Turkey's increasing influence in many African countries worrying France?
It reflects the sort of leadership competition between Turkey and France when it comes to the Maghreb. And that's not only linked to the economic aspects, but also to the diplomatic aspects, to the geopolitical aspects of this bilateral relation between Algeria and Turkey. Here I have in mind the Libyan question, where Algeria is increasingly involved
as one of the most important actors of the region, and Turkey is also pushing Algeria to be on her side on that matter. And France is having a very different position when it comes to the Libyan question. So this is just an example to show that there is clearly a competition between France and Turkey, and Macron's saying are immediately related to that.
Some analysts believe what is happening between Algeria and France is inseparable from the severing of relations between Algeria and neighboring Morocco, which normalized ties with the Israeli regime and betrayed the Palestinians. Is France pressurizing Algeria on behalf of the Israeli regime due to the move by Algiers to block the regime's observer status in the African Union?
I think Algeria will continue to defend the Palestinian voice within the international fora, including the African Union. And when there will be a chance to listen an increasing impact of Israel on the continent, it will do so. One of the triggers of the tensions between Algeria and Morocco, because Algeria has also cut its diplomatic ties with Morocco, is the normalization of Morocco's relationship with Israel after the signatory of the Abraham agreements. So all these factors are interrelated. And I don't see French pushing in particular for this agenda because they know that, overwhelmingly speaking, the Algerian regime remains against anything that comes from Israel.
The Algerian foreign minister says he is optimistic that the current crisis with France will also be resolved in the future. Let's take a listen.
We have no doubt that the current crisis would be solved in the future, at any given time in the future, bearing in mind and taking into account all the principles, all the interests of the Algerian side.
Now, our last question. Should we expect further escalation between France and Algeria in future?
A tipping point. In this bilateral crisis between France and Algeria. So I don't think that it will go further deep, but the consequences of this crisis remain relatively inconsumable, in the sense that we don't know the full consequences of that. I think that it won't be limited to the military and to the recalling of the ambassador. There might be also other decisions taken, but these are, I would say, indirect consequences rather than direct decisions taken by the Algerian regime against France.
Well, thank you, Raoul Farah, Algerian activist and commentator, for your insight on the current standoff between France and Algeria. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the activities of the United States Military Command for Africa. Stay with us.
Listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
2008, the United States Military Command for Africa, known as AFRICOM, was established and is currently headquartered in Germany. The formation of AFRICOM was followed by a new scramble for Africa, including plans by the U.S. to expand and strengthen its hegemony in this continent.
The U.S. claims that AFRICOM operations in Africa are about counterterrorism. However, since the establishment of this U.S. command, Africa has seen a massive increase in incidents of violence attributed to Takfiri terrorist groups. As if that is not enough, U.S. forces in Africa have killed many civilians while terrorists roam freely across the continent. An investigation by Amnesty International has revealed that the U.S. killed innocent civilians during an airstrike inside Somalia instead of hitting Al-Shabaab terrorists. Amnesty says such indiscriminate attacks in which civilians are killed or injured can constitute war crimes.
Targeting individuals who are not directly participating in active hostilities, indiscriminately attacking them and killing them, amounts to, you know, a breach of international humanitarian law, and that can amount to war crimes.
And to discuss more about U.S. military presence in Africa, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a coordinator for the U.S. Out of Africa Network and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first question, what do you think were the secret objectives of the U.S. government when it formed its military command for Africa?
Well, the purpose of AFRICOM is to use U.S. military power to impose U.S. control of African land, resources, and labor to service the needs of U.S. multinational corporations and the wealthy in the United States. And U.S. military presence in Africa didn't begin with AFRICOM, but AFRICOM now formalizes that presence with better coordination and strategic focus for realizing the long-term geopolitical goals of U.S. imperialism in Africa, which includes beating out China and others in the battle for power in the Atlantic continent. Another objective is the long-standing effort to prevent the emergence of any independent African influence or force. And the war in the DRC is an illustrative example. The U.S. initially worked with Belgium to assassinate the first prime minister of the newly independent Democratic Republic of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, because of the threat his leadership posed to U.S. and Western control of strategic raw materials in the DRC. AFRICOM brings this effort into the present day through military might.
The U.S. has fully militarized its so-called war on terror in Africa. Many security experts in Africa disagree with this approach dictated by the U.S. as it has only increased terrorism. Despite AFRICOM announcing that it's in Africa to combat terrorism, we have since seen a rapid increase of terrorism. What could be the reason behind this?
AFRICOM isn't in Africa to fight terrorism, and the U.S. military presence is a destabilizing presence. Terrorism is actually a useful pretext for the U.S. to assert its power. In that sense, AFRICOM has been a success. The United States has vastly expanded its power and influence on the continent through AFRICOM as it vies for full-spectrum global dominance in the competition with folks like China and Russia. If the goal is to fight and end terrorism, AFRICOM is a woeful failure, as you've shared. The number of incidents of violence attributed to terrorist organizations have increased fivefold since AFRICOM was established 13 years ago. But ending terrorism is not the goal. Terrorism is a byproduct of imperialism, and claims of fighting against it are used for public relations purposes. Ending terrorism and liberating Africa from the clutches of U.S. imperialism means shutting down AFRICOM and removing all U.S. forces from the continent and the world.
Many innocent civilians, including women and children, have been killed during U.S. airstrikes in Somalia. AFRICOM arrogantly stated that it had not paid any compensation in Somalia for civilian casualties it had acknowledged since 2017.
Now, civilians have borne the brunt of AFRICOM operations in Africa, especially in countries such as Somalia, where the U.S. refuses to compensate the victims. Clearly, AFRICOM does not value the lives of African people. What's your take on this?
The lives of millions of African people are simply bargaining chips that are played by the United States in the new scramble of Africa, which is similar to what took place in the 1880s when the colonial powers fought over which of them would dominate which parts of the resource-rich continent. In Somalia specifically, AFRICOM has caused the murder of thousands and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. For AFRICOM, what matters more than black or African lives is what Vice Admiral Robert Mueller, former AFRICOM deputy, admitted is protecting the free flow of natural resources from Africa to the global market. The U.S. has also used the framework of enemy combatants to decide that a victim is an enemy without having to provide any proof. This allows them to ignore the suffering of countless civilian victims and their quest for compensation, all in pursuit of U.S. interests.
Now, Mali and Guinea are two mineral-rich West African countries that saw military takeover this year. The coup leaders in both countries claimed that they want to put an end to corruption and human rights abuses. But the military officers who led the coups in Mali and Guinea had close links to the United States and France, and these has raised suspicions about other motives behind these military takeovers.
In 2018, thousands of people in Ghana rallied in their capital, Accra, to protest a deal that would have given the United States military an expanded role in the country. A politician from Ghana speaks here during a protest march against U.S. military presence in his country.
If you allow for a permanent U.S. military presence in our country, we have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence, what it has attracted. It has attracted terrorism, it has attracted destabilization, and we don't want Ghana to be destabilized. We also say that this agreement is lopsided, it's one-sided, there's nothing in it for Ghana apart from the dangers.
Following the protests, the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, categorically rejected claims that the United States will set up a military base in the country.
Let me state with the clearest affirmation that Ghana has not offered a military base and will not offer a military base to the United States of America.
Now, clearly, many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in this continent. Now, will all the leaders listen to the people and demand complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa?
Well, imperialism is a global system that requires the enforcement of certain conditions, and that's exactly why autocratic leaders are supported by the West and Western imperialist projects. These governments are the neocolonial political cover for the West's control of the land, labor, and markets of the colonized. So though many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in their countries, a mass or popular movement is needed to demilitarize and depose imperialism and militarism on the continent, and that really requires the construction of a mass-based geostrategic vision that prioritizes the removal of AFRICOM and other European military projects. That's why the demands of the U.S. Out of Africa campaign include the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa, the demilitarization of the African continent, and the closure of U.S. bases throughout the world. That's crucial in this effort.
Well, there you have it. A mass movement is needed to eject U.S.-led imperialist forces in Africa. Thanks a lot, Mr. Tunde Osazua, for your insight. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. God bless you all.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new report describes two January 6 protest insiders who claimed they worked back-to-back with several Republican House members, including Representatives Paul Gosar, Lauren Boebert, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Andy Biggs, Louis Gohmert, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and their senior staffers, who they allege were intimately involved in planning both Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss and the January 6th events that turned violent. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by William Rivers Pitt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Explosive Report Says GOP Congress Members Helped Plan January 6th Capitol Attack. Stay tuned for more. January 6th protest organizers say they participated in dozens of planning meetings with members of Congress and the White House staff, wrote the Rolling Stone headline. The report describes two January 6th protest insiders who claim they worked back-to-back with several Republican House members, including Representatives Paul Gosar, Lauren Boebert, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Andy Biggs, Louis Gohmert, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and their senior staffers, who they allege were intimately involved in planning both Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss and the January 6 events that turned violent. These two January 6 organizers have begun communicating with congressional investigators and sharing new information about what happened when the former president's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, according to Rolling Stone. This is the first report that the committee is hearing major new allegations from potential cooperating witnesses. While there have been prior indications that members of Congress were involved, this is also the first account detailing their purported role and its scope. The two sources also claim they interacted with members of Trump's team, including former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who they describe as having had an opportunity to prevent the violence. If confirmed, this report would put the word bombshell to shame and would also go a long way toward explaining why Trump's congressional allies have been turning themselves inside out trying to change the subject. An unfortunate grain of salt must be taken with this, however. Rolling Stone's journalistic reputation took a hit over its reporting on the University of Virginia rape scandal 7 years ago. Because of this, confirmation by other news outlets is essential. There is good reason to believe the Rolling Stone report is sound. First and foremost, it reveals that these two sources have been actively cooperating with the January 6th Commission, providing specific details on who was involved with which aspects of the insurrection. Such a claim could and likely would be debunked by members of that committee if it weren't accurate. The Rolling Stone report comes in tandem with a damning Washington Post report detailing how space within the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. was used as a war room for efforts to overthrow the 2020 election. They called it the Command Center, reports the Post. A set of rooms and suites in Push Willard Hotel, a block from the White House, where some of President Donald Trump's most loyal lieutenants were working day and night with one goal in mind: overturning the results of the 2020 election. Their activities included finding and publicizing alleged evidence of fraud, urging members of state legislatures to challenge Biden's victory, and calling on the Trump-supporting public to press Republican officials in key states. Central to this effort was the enormous pressure brought to bear against Vice President Mike Pence to refuse to certify the election results on the same day as the insurrection took place. While Pence wobbled badly under the strain, seeking advice at one point from fellow former Indiana Senator Dan Quayle, he ultimately chose to certify the election results. At the peak of the day's violence, Pence was whisked from the building by the Secret Service as a mob of furious Trump supporters stormed the halls of Capitol demanding his head. The Willard operation was so serious, in fact, that its members brought in a retired Army colonel named Phil Waldron, specialized in psychological operations, to aid in the overall effort. Multiple witnesses are set to testify under subpoena before the committee about what they knew of Puri-mediated plans for violence on January 6th and how high up the chain that pre-mediation went. One of them, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, who said on his podcast the day before the violence that all hell is going to break loose and tomorrow is game day, is ignoring his subpoena. By a vote of 229 to 202, the House approved a measure holding Bannon in contempt of Congress, and his legal fate now rests in the strangely quiescent hands of Attorney General Merrick Garland. There are many moving pieces to this, but a sense is growing that those involved in planning and executing the attempted overthrow of the election on January 6th may be running out of room to maneuver. Representative Benny Thompson, chair of the January 6th investigation committee, told CBS News, "There is no question the attack that day was premeditated." One wonders if Thompson is among the committee members who have spoken to the sources in the Rolling Stone report. It sure sounds like it. 30 years ago this week, the remnants of Hurricane Grace were engulfed by a powerful nor'easter in the waters off the mid-Atlantic states. The combined system